Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 254th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of Waterfront Winters, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Diami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop and Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop. Hi, guys.
Good morning, hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. No. Well, okay. So, Kyle, what is this about magnets? What's attracting you to them?
They're very attractive. They're very attractive. Well, I think everyone's familiar with those rare earth magnets that you can flip the little switch and they stay glued down to your tabletop and you use them as, you know, feather boards. Mm-hmm. In fact, I have a feather board with those built in. It's fantastic.
It's wonderful.
And then you have those little square ones that you can use as stops and whatnot. Those little square ones are like $50.
Mm-hmm.
They're expensive as hell. Well, I was on Instagram and someone happened to mention these strong like bull magnets, and they are rare earth magnets, and they're little round magnets, and apparently they stick extremely well. People are using these as stops. In fact, they even have a little kind of rubber bumper around them. They're round, and they come in all kinds of colors. But for like $27 to $30, you can get 5 of these.
Oh wow!
Yeah. So they seem to be great. Like I said, this is just something that piqued my interest that I saw. I haven't bought any, but I noticed they do have the Lone Star Texas Edition magnets, so that's definitely what I'm buying. Of course, I think these are a few dollars more than their standard magnets.
But hey,
it's worth it. It's Texas style, damn it. Anyway, I'll probably pick some of these up here in the near future. But I saw those and went, hey, these are pretty neat. So yeah. Once I get them and try them out, I'll be sure to update y'all.
Do you need them making a chair?
Not really, but, I make other things besides chairs. I make jigs for chairs. And when I'm making those jigs, sometimes I need to stop.
I gotcha. All right. I'm with you.
But they seem really neat, and I think there could be a lot of uses for them around the shop. So definitely probably order some here in the near future. But I figured if other folks hadn't heard about them, you can find them at slbmagnets.com. Strong like bull. So anyway. So, with that said, what's in the shop, guys? Diami, what's going on with you?
These days, I'm still monkeying around with that silly entertainment center top.
How's the gate coming?
I've not touched the gate in a while. The gate, okay. A while. It's been like 2 weeks, but we've been recording a lot. So, the gate, the first half of the gate is installed. The frame is. I still have to skin it. But the frame for the second half is fabricated and sitting outside my shop. And next time I'm working, I'll get that hung. And then I'll skin them. And the skinning takes mere minutes because it's just putting fence slats on with a nail gun. The only tricky thing is kind of measuring how wide they are and ripping the slats because I don't want it to look like any slats are ripped. So what I'll typically do is I'll figure out, I need, 15 and a half slats, and then I'll rip an eighth of a slat off 6 of them so that it fits instead of just making one and a half slat. So I got to do a little bit of math to do that, but they're easy enough to rip on the bandsaw and just slide them through. So I don't foresee that taking all that long. It's just a matter of actually doing the work.
Mm-hmm. And what would you use the bandsaw as opposed to the table saw?
I use the bandsaw because it's not covered by an entertainment center.
Ah.
Back to the entertainment center.
That makes...
Yeah. I mean, you could do this on the entertainment...
on the entertainment center.
You could do it on the table saw. But all things being equal, having done a lot of the fence work on the bandsaw, I think I would do it on the bandsaw regardless. Like it mm-hmm. you know, it rips wonderfully.
You mean on the table saw? You haven't done most of it on the table.
No, I've done most of the fence work on the bandsaw because the table saw has been covered with the entertainment center, okay, the whole project. Okay.
Yeah, that's and, what I said. You said bandsaw yeah. instead of table saw.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, but no, if
just
both
sure it's clear.
If yeah. both tools were free and accessible, I think I would still lean towards the bandsaw.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, essentially, what I'm ripping is
yeah.
Is 3/4 pine or some equivalent.
Oh yeah.
So it's not hard to rip it on the on any of them really, but the bandsaw does a nice job.
Good. Hmm. Well, I've just been turning parts for the rocker. Turned 4 legs, which Sean busted my chops, and they look like poorly executed vampire stakes, which they do. And which I thought was a great comment too, because these are legs for a rocker, so they don't have any slender, graceful end to them, you know, towards the foot. They just kind of end. They will get some additional shaping once you have put them into the attached them to the rockers. Well, not attached them to the rockers, but fitted the rockers to them. Mm-hmm. There'll be some additional shaping done to the bottom of the feet. But yeah, when he mentioned that, I went, yeah, he's not wrong. So
it was a joke.
It was a great joke.
They were wonderfully consistent in their shape. So obviously yeah. you're doing it right. But I just thought
that was
funny.
Yeah, and once again, you know, it's been a month or two since I turned anything. So the first one took me what seems like forever. But I quickly sped up there. But one thing I've never turned, this is my first experience with it because I'm still a neophyte turner, is oak.
Oh,
and
okay.
Boy, that stuff is nasty to turn. You got these hard, sharp chips, just, well, this is kiln dried stuff too, just flying at you. And I work on a mat, and when I was cleaning up afterwards, I noticed I had these little pieces of wood just impaled into the mat where I'd stepped on them, and they just, you know, like a little needle into the mat. So they didn't vacuum up, put it that way. But since I got a lot more turning, I'm not going to sit there and pull them out one by one. But anyway, it was kind of interesting. But yeah, it's definitely, you can definitely feel it on your hands. So I'm turning oak. Probably a lot of people go, yeah, that's the way oak, especially kiln dried oak turns, but you know, it was a mess.
Do you worry about chip out?
No, it doesn't chip out that much. But it's just when the chips do come off the lathe, they're just sharp, and it's also a very coarse wood too. So they tend to be, it's not as nice as turning like maple or even any other wood. Mahogany even. Turns a whole lot nicer, you know, poplar. It doesn't turn as nice as those. It's more of a full face shield type turning experience.
Okay.
So, just, but that's what I'm doing.
The way that grain reverses on itself.
Yeah.
It's the wanes and the grain.
So, Sean, what are you doing?
Nothing other than pulling weeds in my backyard whenever I get a chance. And poison ivy sucks.
Oh, some of those weeds are poison ivy, huh?
Some of them. Yeah.
Can you identify those, or
can you just identify them
later?
They're the ones that leave a rash.
I will say, no, I got a text from my son. I forget where we were just out somewhere, and this is a great text to get from your 15-year-old. We have a problem. I went, oh, Jesus, what is this? You're home with your brother. What's going on? He goes, we have poison ivy. Like, how bad? He goes, oh, there's a bunch of it. So I got home and I actually went and I couldn't find it. You have to understand how overgrown my backyard can be at points.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then later, a week later or so, I was out and I was like, oh, found it. And I know where it is. I went inside. I got gloves. I got a long sleeve shirt on, jeans, and went after it. And this is my own fault for being exposed to it. But you know, I get in there with everything I got and dig it out by the mm-hmm. by the root, and it's fun in my, well, in this case where I'll find a little sprout of three leaves of green, you know, trick, leave them alone. Mm-hmm. And I'll dig down and I grab it, and as I'm pulling, it's pulling through my legs and in the grass behind me. So it's just very healthy. I ended up taking out like a full grocery bag worth of vine bundled together. Okay. And then I went back days later and went into a different section of the hill and went after the weeds in not such a careful way. And apparently I rubbed up against some. So then I got some on my inner wrists and knees and stuff because I was wearing shorts. So I don't like poison ivy.
Yeah, we either don't have poison ivy down here or I've never contacted it. But so are you like in a full hazmat suit while you're removing these or what?
No, not at all. And you can be. It's not. It's oil. It's not gas or anything. Okay. You have to physically.
Well, I'm just picturing you in like one of those Tyvek suits, you know.
Yeah. No. Basically, my program is to dress to protect, and then immediately take them off and clean myself. So everything goes in the wash right away, and I take a shower right away. But still, I mean, that's not everything. But it is, it's just an oil, and if it soaks into your skin, you get it, and it's a rash for a while. It just seemed like, in my case, it was like a delayed thing, and the spots are showing up 6 days later. I'm like, what the hell's going on? Just a slow reaction. And I just have this instant feeling of itch, like, all the time. Hate it.
Well, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, what do you say we get into our main topic
of
today's show? So we're talking about shop upgrades. So just talking about things we'd like to do with our shop and machinery, stuff of that nature. So anybody have any current issues with their shop or things that they'd like to change?
Could I talk about something that gets under my skin every time I hear people talk about their shops on the 1,000 other woodworking podcasts that are out there right now?
Sure. That they're too small?
No, it's the electric.
Ah.
I don't understand people's reluctance to run their own electric.
I ran all my electric, even the 220 lines.
I did the same thing.
You mean reluctance to like add circuits or just physically run
both? Adding a line is not that hard. Adding a new circuit and certainly running the cable and installing the outlets is unbelievably simple. And yeah, you should buy a simple, like a Time Life book on it is really all you need. So you want to be safe, but it's not rocket science.
Yeah, and Time Life book is probably better than the internet.
I would say so. But
in the realm of DIY, changing an outlet or a switch or something is common and easy.
Right.
Wiring, adding wires, is a kind of a new ball game. I'm the son of an electrician. I am not in that ballpark. I've totally wired new circuits into this house. I have no problem with it. But I understand electricity is scary. We're taught that it's scary.
We're taught that it's scary, but 110 is not as scary as people think. And you need to have a good, healthy respect for 230. But even then, circuits pop. So make sure you're not what it's bridging on, and you're okay.
Make it sound so simple.
Well, every time I do, is it 230 or 240? I know it's not actually 220.
220, 221, whatever it takes.
Yeah.
I always call it 220, but it's actually 240.
It's 240, okay. Every time I do it, I screw it up. But I understand, that I shouldn't be touching it and, the basics not to get electrocuted. There's too many wires. I don't know where they go. And at one point I scraped the jacketing off the wire, sliding it into my circuit box and caused a little puff of smoke at my circuit box. But the circuits break and they turn off. Yeah. So I'm not saying you throw the switch and run away, but throw the switch, see what happens. If there's an issue, it pops, you sort it out. Too many people are like, well, I don't have the money to bring the electrician in, so I have to run everything off 115-amp circuits. Like, no, you idiot. Just go, spend $100 on cable and a breaker and install the damn thing yourself. It's not hard.
So is it that it's a combination of the fear of doing that and problem-solving skills?
I guess. I don't know why people don't do it. Like, I replaced about 80% of the wiring in my last house. Like, this is not... It's not intimidating to me at all. And I don't think I'm particularly good at it. I think it's just not that hard.
Well, it's like a lot of things. You know, plumbing is another one of those things that people kind of avoid. It's that's really not that difficult. And I agree with you, but electricity is, you know, hey, it can kill you. So, you know, if you don't feel comfortable, I wouldn't recommend someone doing it. But, you know, to your point, Diami, it's not hard. Now, I've never, you know, ran a completely new circuit or anything like that. And based on where my box is, I'm not sure I'd be comfortable doing that. But I have run, you know, all the lines in my shop, doubled the number of outlets. I didn't have 220 in my shop, and I did steal some 220 going out to a future expansion of the house and ran that back into the shop. So I got a 220 line in there. So, and I plan on at one point, if I ever need it, to run another 220 that's dedicated to a dryer circuit. Since I have a gas dryer, I don't need it. But anyway, those type of things I don't have a problem with, but I can see where somebody might.
If
they don't feel comfortable around it.
If getting comfortable with it is the difference between getting that kick-ass bandsaw or table saw or joiner and not, I'd get comfortable with it.
Well, that's why I have 220 in my shop, because I wanted that kick-ass joiner. Planer combo machine.
All right.
So, it's not difficult. I agree with you there. And I've run it, and I'd feel comfortable running it in any house. I can definitely see your point. It's not rocket science.
It's not. You brought up a good point. It's plumbing is, I think, similar. I would never. Except in extreme cases, I don't think I'll ever hire a plumber because that is very simple. If you understand what to do it.
See, yeah. I'm the opposite way with plumbing. Like, I would hire a plumber, but it's not because plumbing is hard. It's because plumbing is nasty. And
yeah, depends on what you're doing. That's for sure.
Some plumbing is nasty. You know, I had to change the shower faucet in this house when I moved in. It was an old, outdated thing. So I went in and I cut out the tree of, you know, from the access point, and I soldered in new stuff, and that's easy.
Oh yeah, I would do that in a heartbeat. I wouldn't.
Yes, because that's not disgusting. It's actually quite simple. I get you drains and stuff. I've got it where my washer drains is near where the sink above drains, and so you get gurgling in the sink above. So I need to like reroute that washer drain. I don't even want to do that because it's probably pretty funky inside there.
Yeah.
But it's still doable.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't have problems with most plumbing, you know, as long as it's already been established, repairing it and stuff of that nature, I don't have a problem with. However, adding to it, I think might be a different issue. And to get this back into the shop, one of the things I wish I had in my shop was, you know, some sort of slop sink.
Mm-hmm.
Would love to have that in my shop. But the way the drains run in my house, I think it would be very hard to hook up a drain to a slop sink in my shop. It would just be really hard. It'd be easy to run water to it. I think that the drainage would be a problem, and that's something I would probably have to get a plumber in and say, hey, how would you actually do this?
But so not the most, elegant of solutions, but what I have in my house is I'm on a well and septic system.
Mm-hmm.
And my washer is in the basement, which is physically lower than, my sump crock is obviously in my basement, but my washer itself cannot physically drain into a drain. It's not in the floor of the basement. Everything comes from the floor above, and actually I'm really near where it exits my house, and the drain actually exits about 4.5 feet off the floor of the basement. Ooh. So you can't get to that without help. So on my washer, where my washer discharges, it actually goes into a self-contained sump crock, which sits on my basement floor, has a tiny little sump pump in it. And so as that water goes in, when it fills and the plunger hits, it pushes it out. And there's a check valve in the line, and it works like a standard crock would. But you can actually do that in an open space above the floor and get water to go upward. When needed. That's a basic sump system. I mean, that's what it, that's what your drain. Well, again, in my case, to get to grade because I'm underground, my basement sump goes up and out, you know, out the back, but it has a pump and a hole.
Yeah. Well, see, in my shop, the main drain for our house runs right through the walls of my shop. Okay. So I can access that drain real easily, mm-hmm. but it's, I don't know how big that pipe is, probably 4 inches, maybe six, something like that. Mm-hmm. I'd be, you know, it's not something that I feel confident, putting a hole in and putting a drain to a slot sink into, you know, I think, yeah, maybe I need a professional because I'm sure they would have to cut that and probably put in some sort of, you know, device. And it's probably super simple, but, you know, once again, not something I really want to go messing with the main drain line of my house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Understood.
Yeah. So, but, you know, that's one of those days. So, y'all.
That would be a common thing that I think people would like in their shop would be a, mm-hmm. a sink, a wash sink, or anything just to. To clean off application brushes or rags or
I
can't imagine having space for one.
Yeah.
Well, no, and that space is an obvious concern. Diami, you and I have small spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That would be something. Even if it was a 2 foot square sink, it's space that otherwise could be used better. Maybe.
Yeah.
So you know, Diami, you can walk outside to the hose.
Yes.
All right, in most applications. Right, just out of the driveway. But I mean, it's not a necessity, but something that would be a nice addition.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So any other current issues within your shops?
Lighting.
Lighting?
Piss poor lighting. So that's just easy enough. I've got power accessible. I just need to get more lamps. And hang them up. I just have a single 4 foot LED, two tubes, I guess a pair of tubes,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, just plug in and go. And that fills it just fine, except it's like a drawstring thing. If I could wire it to have switches, you know, and that would be, again, nice. Not necessary, but nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, that I could improve on is some lighting. And I think I could probably accomplish that. I think I have enough banks of lighting. It's probably been a good 5 years since I replaced the fluorescent tubes in there. And I know they do kind of lose output over time. So mm-hmm. that's probably an easy solution.
My dad just did some conversions to his, to mm-hmm. make them LED, and they're mm-hmm. not, they're ballast free. Somehow. Right. So he mm-hmm. keeps the shrouds, but takes the ballast out and puts these LED guys in there. And, you know, he's did in his shop, which is a 24 by 48 barn with an 11 foot ceiling.
Yeah.
You know, he's done that enough that it's, you know, he said it's amazing. The improvement in light and then the energy saving of the LED all at the same time.
Now, I have a question for you since you're the son of electrician.
Go.
So dust collection. So I have one of these, don't think that they don't make them anymore, but they make something very similar, but it's a highly regarded single stage Delta dust collector, 1.5 horsepower motor, something like that. Mm-hmm. Got, you know, the big dust deputy and a 55 gallon drum. So I've converted it into a two stage unit. Now, what always chaps me is having to run over there and turn that thing on and off.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's 110, of course. I was thinking about one of these Wi-Fi enabled smart home plugs on that thing.
As long as the amperage is rated properly, that's which might
exactly
be an issue.
What I was going to say.
15, you know, it's on the dust collector hooks into. I went to the thing to see what it was recommending, and it's, I think it at peak when it turns on is 12 amps, and those plugs are rated for 15 amps.
Okay.
So,
how would
I have made sure it's not a magnetic switch because I've gone up and turned it off at the breaker box. And, you know, when you turn it back on, it comes back on. So it's not a magnetic switch in the dust collector.
How would you trigger a smart switch in this case?
Alexa, turn on the dust collector. No.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, or really, when it's running, it might be hard to get that message through to turn it off.
Well, probably with the phone or something like that, because my phone's usually with me.
So, I mean, aren't there little things that have a tiny little key fob?
Yeah.
That you can Velcro onto your tools or on your work shirt or whatever.
Yeah.
And I mean, those have to be as cheap as the switches at this point.
No, I think they're fairly expensive.
Are they?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, because the switches are becoming completely commoditized. You can get a no-name brand off Amazon real cheap.
Yeah. And it's much cheaper. And I think a lot of those things are made for your 220s with magnetic switches and stuff like that in them. So I think that's why they are expensive.
Yeah.
What I would recommend is just get a smaller shop and you can just reach over and turn it on like I do.
Well, the shop's not giant, but it still saved me a few steps.
Well, and there's other ways of DIYing this if you really want to get into it. I think Bob Claggett in his shop, mm-hmm. he's done something so that
I believe he's got it. Has.
If he doesn't have a switchboard that is somehow accessible, but he did something with remote operation of blast gates and dust collection.
Oh yeah, they do. I don't have to worry about that. I do.
Yeah,
you know, I do.
But just the power access of getting a thing on, I think he's got that somehow done. So there's many ways of doing it.
I think Mark Spags, I think he has that electronic dust gates.
Mm-hmm. If anyone does, I'm sure he does.
Yeah, yes. they're pricey as hell though, I believe. But
no doubt.
So anything else that y'all have issues with in the shop in your workflow solutions that y'all have done that you're all proud of?
Stuff that I'm something I haven't done yet, but I'm like I've got the parts for. I just need to do is the joiner mobile base. And I've had these parts welded up to make a custom joiner mobile base so that the joiner moves perpendicular to the length of the bed. Mm-hmm. Because
you can pull it out off the wall.
Exactly. Right?
And push it right back.
Exactly. Everyone that I've seen commercially available, both from Powermatic and aftermarket ones, they all move lengthwise. And maybe I have a very limited imagination, but I can't imagine why I would want to move it in that direction. Even if the shop was much bigger, I'm thinking I would want to move it sideways, not lengthwise.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I will be very excited, and I will win.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to win 14 inches by the length of the damn thing, which has got to be like 8 foot long. So it's a tangible amount of space I will win. But I've been too. There's always other things to be done. I've not bothered to break down and build it yet. And as time has changed, I think the wheels I bought, I want to get different wheels because the wheels I have, they're correctly weighted, and they have locks, but they spin in 360. You know, so I think I need to replace it with just fixed wheels that just, you know, run in a linear direction so that it can't. I don't want to have to swing this whole thing around every time I pull it in and out. I think I just need to slide it in and out.
Well, it'd be interesting if there are wheels that can lock in an orientation, kind of like, you know, instead of locking where they won't move at all, but lock in a certain orientation or be free to swivel. I don't know if they make such a thing or not.
I'm not sure. But as I've thought about it more and more, I can't think of a reason why I need them to swivel. It's just...
Yeah.
They're just going in and out.
Yeah, if two could... Well, no, the orientation you're putting in, you kind of want them all to, should you ever want to remove that thing. I mean, that's the one bear of your situation.
Well, you got it in.
A long shop. Yeah, you got it. Obviously, you got it in there. But, you know, now if it has wheels, wouldn't it be easier to be able to get it the hell out of there?
No, quite frankly, what you do is you take you unbolt it from the base, and it has those moving posts, and you pull them out. And I had four lengths of pipe, and they were like 24-inch lengths of pipe, and we slid them over the posts to make much longer handles. And with four people, you just pick it up and walk it. That's how I got it in.
No. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I have the exact opposite problem. I have almost all my machinery on wheels, but it all stays in the same place. So why do I have them on these mobile bases? So, you know, it's like my drill press is on a mobile base. It never moves. My bandsaw is on a mobile base. It never moves. Same with my table saw. My lathe is on a mobile base, and it would probably stay on one because I can move that around as needed. But, you know, I got all this equipment on mobile bases, yet I never, ever move it.
Do the bases, do they cause any interference?
No, not really. I think the only one that really is idiotic is the one on my drill press, because my drill press would probably be a little bit, it's not unsteady, but it would probably be more steady if I took it off that.
Yes,
it would. Yeah, and you might make the same argument on the bandsaw, but I'm not sure I'd see that much of a difference. But, you know, my table saw, I got a saw stop, and I have their mobile base, which is rock solid. There's no reason to take it off of that. But anyway, but I just thought that was funny. You were talking about that, and I'm going, yeah, I have all my machinery on mobile bases, and it never moves. So, anyway, maybe I can sell you some mobile bases. I won't do what you're wanting to do, but hey. But with that, are there any machinery upgrades that y'all would like to do based on what you have? I got a couple, but.
I would like, I need to work on my planer. It snipes like nobody's business.
Mm-hmm.
And right now the infeed and outfeed tables are not properly aligned. And for the life of me, I can't wrap my head around why it has rollers in the bed that stick up just proud of it. So I think I want to make a new base for it.
Now, what planer is this?
I have a Grizzly 15-inch.
Okay.
It's the Steve Taylor model.
Ah. Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. I should have remembered that.
And it's a wonderful machine. It's got the segmented head, and it leaves a beautiful finish. But it snipes like nobody's business, and I need to address that. And off the top of my head, I'm not exactly sure what to do to address it, because it's getting well beyond my ability.
I assume you can vary the pressure that the rollers are putting on the wood.
Sure, let's say that I can.
I might want to look at that, but I know some people, especially with some of those planers, who just say, "Hey, I just deal with the snipe and make my, you know, if I'm running a piece of lumber through there, I make sure, you know, it's 4 inches longer than I need."
I'm getting a solid 2.5 inches of snipe on both sides. More than I'm comfortable giving up.
Yeah, that's really, yeah. I know, you know, I got that combo machine, that Jet 12-inch combo machine, and I had a little bit of snipe on mine, and I was able to vary the pressure the rollers were putting on it, I guess the last roller before it goes into the cutter head. I kind of lessen that pressure up a little bit and tighten the pressure on the one after the cutter head, and that seemed to solve the problem for me.
Okay.
So just an idea. And I mean, we're talking, you know, there's some screws you can make that adjustment with, or these big Allen head screws you can make adjustments with, and I just, you know, barely turned them, you know, and run a piece of board and barely turn them again on a board through. After doing that 2 or 3 times, I mean, I did not adjust it, you know, that much before I eliminated the snipe.
Well, I'll have to give that a try. There's also that like metal bar that runs along in there too, and I don't know exactly what it does, but I've heard that adjusting that has a big impact on the snipe. It's like a pressure bar.
I don't have that. I got an anti-kickback bar, but
maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah, but mine's different. Mine are these little finger things. So,
well, I have those too. Those are in front of the rollers.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
That's what I would like to improve of my current machinery.
Yeah. Me, I want a bigger bandsaw and a bigger lathe. Those are my two things. But and it's just I just like to have some more capacity. I'd actually like to have two bandsaws, one that I can keep a thin blade on and one that I can keep a blade for resawing on, and bigger. Well, what's the size? You got that 16-inch Laguna?
Yeah.
That would be perfect for me.
It is. I love that saw.
But so something like that. And then I'd like to get a more powerful lathe. But for what I have right now, it's working fine. But that would be some upgrades I'd like to make.
You have a MIDI lathe with a bed extension? Is that what you have now?
Yeah, it's a MIDI lathe. It's a Jet 12-inch variable speed MIDI lathe with a bed extension. So I'd like to get something a little bigger. Mm-hmm. So that would be nice. But like I said, what I have now is working fine. The one thing I need to look at as far as my lathe goes is the height of the lathe. And I saw a couple articles about where you're the height of the lathe that the spindle should be, and I need mm-hmm. to make sure mine is, because I was using a different article when I built my stand. So,
you're talking but, just ergonomically where it's
yeah, ergonomically, yeah. And I forgot who it was. Might have been David Diard or somebody else. It might have been him, but I remember somebody was saying that, you know, they were in their shop turning, and they had a person in there, maybe a student or something, that was like a ergonomic specialist or something like that, was watching them turn. And it might have been Peter Galbraith that said this, now that I think about it. I'm not sure who, but somebody that turns a lot. And they said, oh, everything is great except you know, you're reaching too high or something like that. Your lathe needs to be lower or vice versa. But I remember them saying that, and I think I bookmarked something like that or made a note somewhere. But I need to go back and check and see where the height of my lathe is in relationship to my arms and elbows and whatnot.
Right. Hmm. I would think slightly higher than your elbows, but where you want the center of the.
Yeah, I would think. I know it was something that I ran into at Fine Woodworking Live, and I jotted a note in my phone about that. So I need to go back and look at that. But one of the biggest upgrades I'm looking at doing is kind of changing my workbench. And
what do you have now?
I have now Diami's proud of me. I have an LVL workbench. But it's based on Bob Lang's 21st century workbench, which has two roughly, I think it's about 11 3/4 inch slabs on either side. And then in the middle is a wide gap that you can put tool trays on, or you can flip them upside down, take all the tools out, and it makes a flat level surface.
Right.
And chair making, I like to have that nice wide bench. You know, much wider than your standard cabinet maker's bench. It's just nice to put a chair on there with the feet and have plenty of room, and it's not going to, you know, fall off the back end or front end or whatnot. That can't happen. Don't ask me how I know that. But anyway, so I have these tool trays in there. So I'm thinking about either just taking all the tools out of there and butting those things together and screwing them together and make them a permanent filler that I can then remove. The nice thing about having that gap in there is you can get clamps on the inside of your bench. Mm-hmm. So that makes it real nice for certain operations. So I want to have something that I can still remove easily. So, but I'm thinking about doing that and then relocating all the tools. And mainly I have stuff in there like marking tools and squares and, you know, stuff for the bench. Like dogs and whatnot in those tool trays. So I need to find another home for all of that stuff. And then, you know, just make it work and be a completely solid bench that's like 33 inches wide. Well, no, not that wide. It's about 12, 24, about 30 inches wide. Yeah, probably about 30 inches wide. Or I can take that out and then use that open center area for clamping.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a scenario where you could kind of half and half it, make the vice end a solid thing, removable center but solid, and then still have the tool trays on the far end?
Yeah, that's kind of what I have now. Oh, okay. Actually cobbled together a little longer plywood thing I can put in there, you know, just and then set these tool trays to the side, and then have one tool tray at the end. And that's the setup that my bench is at currently, and that's the way it's remained. So, for instance, those two tool trays are sitting on my table saw right now. So if I got to use my table saw, I got to move those somewhere, you know. So it's like one of those things. And the major issue is finding a home for all the tools that are in the tool tray. And like I said, most of it's layout and marking stuff. So I just need to get constructive and find a new home for that and use it. Yeah, and I could have it where I could have those all, you know, just flipped over and then, you know, flip one back for something. It is, you know, sometimes it's really convenient to have that space there to put something in, but.
Mm-hmm. All you got to do is hang a drawer underneath the bench in an out of the way fashion that can hold your layout tools and stuff. And
yeah, I was actually thinking
still have them at reach.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about doing something like that, putting some sort of real low cabinet that wouldn't interfere with any hold fasts or clamps and doing something like that. So yeah, that's a possibility. I do have, you know, one of those, mechanics tool chests, the Craftsman style thing, real near my bench, and I got it full of all kinds of other junk. So I think if I were able to reorganize that, I might be able to find a drawer or two I could put all that stuff into.
Yeah, do you have a lower shelf on that bench?
No, I do not. I do not. And that's one thing I could also add. And that's another one of the things. You know what? I need to add a shelf to my bench. And, you know, I said that probably five, six years ago.
Still right on that.
Yeah. It's like, I think that's probably one of the biggest things I'd like to do with my bench. And the other thing is put my tail vise back on it. I had a...
took it off.
Yeah, one of those, did just a standard, what do you call it, quick action vise. And I had one of those as a tail vise on my bench. And I took that off and I put the Veritas surface vise on there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it kind of acts like a tail vise.
Yeah,
but it's not,
I am. It's a neat thing, but I wouldn't say it's a replacement for an actual tail vise.
No, it's not as strong and sturdy. However, I've used it a bunch, and I've never needed anything more than what it could grip. So I think it is an interesting solution. But thinking about taking that out and putting the quick-release vise back in there, just because as a chair maker, I could really use that vise. Before, when I was just making flat stuff, it didn't make a lot of sense having that vise there. And that little Veritas thing did all I needed for it to do, and actually worked a little bit better. But I think now that I'm building more chairs, it gives me another angle of attack when I'm, you know, roughing out a seat blank or something like that.
Okay, that makes sense.
So anyway, and luckily I haven't used that quick release vise for anything. It's still sitting over here in a little storage area. So
perfect. Yeah, I have nothing to say in the realm of benches, as I have sawhorses holding up a door. Like that's
right.
Is it a hollow core door or a solid door?
It sure is.
All right.
It's fun to bang out dovetails on that. It shakes a bit.
Hey, well, when it all comes down to it, just about anything will work.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And actually, you were talking about your lathe, so I haven't turned anything in years, but I've got the Jet 1014 little guy. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I just put that up on that door, you know, and right. any minor vibration of your turning is absolutely rattling through it. I have it held down with little F-style clamps, and I've had those shake off and everything. It's really fun.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, anything else shop-wise?
I think the shops are perfect.
Fantastic.
Just the way they are.
Just the way they are.
Don't let anybody tell you yours is wrong.
Exactly. Well, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices then. So I'll start us off. I'm just having a straight out Guinness stout, because sometimes you just got to have a Guinness.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I agree. Just got a buddy of mine was just in Europe. I don't think he went to there, but he was in Wales and England and Italy and Switzerland, and he said he was there for fly fishing, but it was more of a food and drink vacation. But anyway, yeah. he said there. I saw him tonight, and he said here, you know, we're in this pub, and you know they got 24 different taps, and they're all their custom things, so you really got to read what they are before you order. He said, you know, last week I walked into a place, I said I'd like a beer, and you're special. And that was it. There was no options. It was just you get what they've got locally, and that's it. Like, what a cool way of doing it. Mm. Anyway, yeah. Tell me, what do you got?
I'm enjoying Otter Creek Daily Dose IPA, which is a Otter Creek is a brewery in Vermont. They have reasonable distribution. I don't know if they go all the way to Ohio, but
never heard of them.
And it's a session IPA. It's about 5.5, but. Mm-hmm. Still, for what it is, it's not watery at all, and it's not a bad drink.
Nice.
Good. So, Sean, what about you?
I've got a Dogfish Head's Slightly Mighty IPA.
Ah, that's a good one.
It is a good one. I just happened upon it. I don't know when they brought it out or if it's been out for a while, but maybe a new packaging caught my eye. But it was a nice IPA, and on the light side, which is always nice. I think it was like 95 calories is something they present on that. I'm like, yeah, not bad.
Hey, that is not bad. Mm-mm. So, Diami, where can people find you on the interwebs?
I can be found at Diami Plotke on Twitter, at Penultimate Woodshop on Instagram, or Penultimate Beer on Untappd.
And Sean, how about you?
I'm SeanW78 on most every social media, including Untappd.
And you can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters.
And that wraps up this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or Google Play Music. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. There you'll never, then you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. While you're there, please leave us a positive review.
And thank you for listening. You could always follow us on Twitter at @MWA_national. On Instagram at @MWA_podcast, or you could just find a friend and tell them to listen, because that's the best way to share things.
Hear, hear.
So with that, your shop is crap. We really know it. And I think it's time to burn it down and start a new one.